Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We've already heard from Doris Wanty, one of the last surviving WASPs, the pioneering women Air Force service pilots of World War II. And now we're hearing from her husband of 67 years, Mike, who served on the destroyer USS Lardner. When we left off, he explained how, as a newly minted ensign, he was made the Lardner's first lieutenant, even though he didn't know what a first lieutenant was supposed to do. So here's your chance to educate the rest of us, Mike. What does a first lieutenant on a World War II destroyer do?
He's in charge of the hull of the ship. He's in charge of, like, the after steering. He's in charge of all the electrical work, all the plumbing work. He's also the fireman, if you have fires aboard. He's basically the officer in charge of when you're banged up, such as losing a bow or anything, to see that you can get going again.
Mm-hmm.
Along with the first lieutenant, you have the communications officer, you have the engineering officer, you have a guy that did the radar equipment, and the gunner's mate, the gunning officer. The first lieutenant doesn't have anything to do with those people at all. He has to do with the men. He had what they call the first and second divisions of the men on the deck that handled the lines, and I'll call it all the dirty work, keeping the ship clean. I don't know, you're just kind of all-around guy that ran the ship. And then, of course, you had to do your daily work, such as officer of the deck on cruisers, and an ensign never gets that way at all.
Yeah, there's a lot of other guys in line.
No, I mean, I was conning the ship within 3 months. I did well. And for someone never going to sea, to have a destroyer under you, that you could do what you wanted. And I mean do what you wanted. When you were officer of the deck, you were the captain.
Yeah.
You were the boss. You could fire the guns. You could do anything you wanted. Go to general quarters.
Yeah.
Which I did many times. I would be on the deck.
It's a lot of responsibility, too, though.
Oh, yes. And then one captain, he wanted me on at nighttime. For almost 1 year, I had to take the deck from 12 to 4 in the morning.
Ooh.
Every day in storms and... Oh, I can tell you a lot of rough experiences.
Well, that's what we want to hear, but I just realized I neglected to ask you one question that I think is probably significant. I didn't ask you about your father. Was that one of the reasons you chose the Navy, because your father had been a Navy man? He died when you were 15.
I doubt it, because we never discussed World War I at all.
How difficult was that to deal with when you lost your father? Because here you're 15 years old, you're in high school.
Yeah, it wasn't easy. We had to sell the house and move, which we moved to the Claremont Hotel. And my mother got a suite of rooms for my aunt and sister and myself. There was a grammar school right near there for my sister to go to school. It was very convenient for my mother, and so that's why we moved there.
So when you went aboard that ship, as you said, you're awfully young and inexperienced to have so much power on this destroyer. But were there guys aboard who had some stories for what that destroyer had already been through?
Oh, yeah. In August 1942, the Lardner, with other ships, the Lansdowne, which was always with us, and the Duncan, they went through the Panama Canal to the South Pacific. And the Duncan met her fate in the Second Battle of Savo, right off the bat. See, the Lardner, that was part of the squadron, Squadron 12. They helped the landing at Guadalcanal with the Marines. In their first encounter with the enemy, the crew witnessed the sinking of the Wasp. You know, that was one of the carriers?
Yeah.
The Wasp and the Hornet. The men jumped off the Wasp, and the destroyers picked them up out of the water.
You weren't on the ship yet?
No, I was not on.
But you heard some stories about some of those early battles.
Yeah.
After you went aboard that ship, what was your first combat experience, your first engagement with the enemy?
Well, I think about the first thing that I remember is when I left Pearl. Have you ever heard the name of Arleigh Burke?
Uh-huh.
Well, Arleigh Burke was then division commander, not the squadron commander. And we were at the first night out. He was sitting next to me at the wardroom table. And the captain said he needed so many guys, and he was brand new himself, a fellow by name of Schatz. very good captain. He said, who's qualified to be on the deck as a deck officer? And a couple of the officers raised their hands. And he says, well, that doesn't get me around for our shifts, you know, for the next day. And Arlie Burke sitting next to me, he says, well, what about me? And the captain says, oh, no, sir, you're the commander here. No, no. He said, what do you think, I'm not good enough? I don't know how to con a ship? No. He says, sign me up for, I think it was 4 a.m.
Uh-huh.
The captain was kind of reluctant, but he did. And he turns to me and he says, I'll take this young fellow as my junior officer. And the captain said, well, he just came aboard. He says, I don't care whether he did or not. He's got to learn. Fella, you meet me on the bridge at 4, just like that. So when I got on the bridge that night, he says, go out on the wing. You've had training how to con this ship. He says, do you know how to work a maneuvering board? And I said, yes, and I was always good on the maneuvering board. He says, well, don't be ashamed. Go over when you have to change course and speed. Go over to your maneuvering board and give your course and speed from that. So he said, you got to have confidence in yourself. So I did, and we got along together fine. He was with us all the way to we got to, I don't know, maybe Purvis Bay. I forget where he got off. That whole trip, which was about a week, we were with some big cargo vessels. So I got a little training with him. He would tell me little things what to do and everything. So I was qualified pretty fast. When he left, of course, the captain came up one day and he said, you conned the ship today. And I did. He says, I think you're qualified. And that was it. From that time on, I was on the bridge when I wasn't doing my regular chores, which mainly were in the morning. I would wander around the ship. There's no place else to go, and I'd see things wrong and have them done. I had a good chief under me, wonderful man, by the name of Morhan. He was an old captain of a tugboat in New York Harbor.
Huh.
And the Navy had picked him up because he was such a good old-timer. He really knew the ship backwards and forwards. I didn't have anything to worry about. He used to say, if I didn't know what was what, I'll get it done, Mike. He really did everything. I didn't have to do anything. My main job was conning the ship.
Was that kind of exciting for you to be in control of an entire destroyer?
Oh, I have no idea. Not that I can really think of. I never knew, but evidently the men talked behind my back. I didn't know that I had. Yeah, here it is. This is sarcasm about the officers.
Uh-huh.
And it's a story about light globes. Why, I don't know. But turning in electric light globes raised the iron of Asiatic Wanty. For Iron Mike wants all actions routed through him. I am the first lieutenant, he reaffirmed.
So they thought you had a power trip, huh? They're giving you a hard time about it?
Well, I never knew that a lot of them called me Iron Mike until after we got the war was over.
Yeah.
A lot of them called me Iron Mike, and I never knew. And some of them called me Asiatic Wanty. Do you know what it is by being Asiatic? You've been out there for so long. You're just accustomed to everything. Nothing bothers you when you become Asiatic. And nothing really did bother me. We'd go to general quarters, and we'd get shot at by planes, or we'd go bombarding these places, and I don't know, it was just like in a day's work, as far as I was concerned.
Well, give us some examples of those, because I know you have such great respect for the men who served on your ship.
Oh, yes.
You're very proud of the Lardner. Give us a taste of what it was like to be on that destroyer in some of those situations where your guns are firing, whether it's bombarding an island for an invasion or trying to shoot down enemy planes that are heading toward the carriers. Tell us what some of those experiences were like.
I don't know. You just saw it happen. You just did what you're supposed to do. That's all.
And where were you?
I was all over the ship. In other words, if for some reason one of the 20 millimeters would jam, I would get on my phone and holler for one of the guys that was maybe standing by to take over. And then when one of the forward mounts caught on fire, I always took the hoses and went under the... That's why I'm half deaf. I put this fire out and the guns were shooting right over the 5-inch, right over the top of my head. I couldn't hear for about 10 days.
So one of your gun mounts caught on fire?
Yeah.
The 5-inch 38 mount? Or?
Yeah.
So you see this?
Yeah, and so it was my job to put it out.
Because you happened to be right there or you had to come to...
No, I think I came... My station was generally after steering.
Uh-huh.
In case for some reason, the bridge was knocked out and the captain and the exec were killed or something.
Right.
Then after steering, would have to take over. So that was my main station. And the captain used to tell me, if anything happens tonight, be sure and get this ship out to sea.
So you're there. You see this gun mount on fire.
Yeah, so I put it out. You sure want to get it out in a hurry because the ship has got all kinds of ammunition that can blow it up.
Yeah, including most of those mounts had ammunition lining the walls on the inside.
Yeah.
So that could be going off
at
any moment and kill you.
Yeah.
So what were you thinking while you were doing that?
You don't think. You just do it.
But you said something. You said that's why your hearing is damaged. So in that time you were fighting the fire?
Well, that particular time
I lost my
hearing because the guns were going off. They were still shooting, and they were shooting over me. They'd shoot about every 30 seconds, I guess.
So you experienced hearing loss then at the time?
Oh, yeah.
In the immediate aftermath, your hearing was damaged?
Yeah.
Wow.
Doctor didn't say anything. He says, you'll be all right. That was with everybody. You'll be all right.
Are there some times that you look back on when you were on the Lardner and you remember what happened and you can picture it in your mind and you ask yourself, how did I survive that? Or maybe say, well, hey, I was pretty fortunate to survive that.
There is one, and I don't like to talk about it. And if I do tell you, I may crack in talking about it, but I'll tell you, it happened at Christmas time. This is why I hate Christmas.
Still today, 70 years later, you hate Christmas.
In a way, I don't know if I can tell you or not. It happened at Bougainville. We helped the Marines go ashore, and then the bodies started coming back, and they would come back in baskets. And one of the, you shouldn't have done this. This boy, they put on the wardroom table. He had no arms, no legs. And he's burned over most of his body. And all we could do was give him morphine. And he wanted to hear White Christmas all the time. It was a record. He would play over and over and over and over. And it took us about 10 hours, I guess, to get to a forward hospital on Vella La Vella. And the doctor said to me, he says, I won't let him die, Mike. I'll get him ashore. And he did. But he died once he got there. But he didn't die on the ship. I've always felt bad. I never got his name or his father and mother. I've always wanted to write to her. He was about 17, Marine, nice young guy. I shouldn't.
It's okay. I'm sorry, Mike.
You don't realize. I happens if I ever think about it. And at Christmas time, it's double. They keep playing White Christmas. I've gotten used to it. But to talk about it, it's different.
But over the years, if you're somewhere and White Christmas comes
you
on,
you never can forget it.
Yeah.
No. Then shortly after that, Halsey came aboard and he wanted us to make, we had done all kinds of going after different places, islands.
Yeah.
Going up before we got to Bougainville, he wanted us to go in our squadron to Rabaul, and he made it clear that this was it's on print. I think in Morrison's book, he admitted that it was a suicide mission.
Well, we're all glad it didn't turn out that way, and we'll hear about that mission to Rabaul from 96-year-old Mike Wanty when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.